You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming. All right, there we go. Now I can hear.
Excellent.
All right. Yeah, a bit of a loose wire, I think.
So, how are you going? We can all have moments where we're a bit loose.
Yeah, exactly. So, how are you going, Kate?
Not too bad. And yourself, Kieran?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Not too bad. So, I suppose, you know, just for the listeners, do you want to give yourself a little bit of an introduction? You know, just talk a bit about who your mob is, you know, what you do for a living?
Yep, sure. Okay. So, you and Murung, g'day, in Wiradjuri. I am a Wiradjuri woman. But I've never had the joy or privilege of living on country because, you know, colonisation is a bit like that. In fact, we're one of those families that didn't talk about it for a very long time, that we were mob because of our, you know, grandparents and great-grandparents' history.
Yeah.
So we didn't really start talking about it until after my grandmother passed. But it's been an interesting journey ever since. And we were kind of, you know, like most of us are, we're kind of aware before. But, yes, I grew up in Brisbane on Yugra Turnbull country, on Yugra Creek, on a nice freshwater creek, which is handy because, you know, us Wiradjuri mob, we're freshwater people. And as I've gotten older, I've really been able to see those connections about why I did some of the things I did when I was young, like, you know, spend school this week in the creek rather than down the Gold Coast like everyone else did. That kind of stuff. So, and it was actually Anagra Creek, we call it in English, Anagra Creek, where I learnt to really hate stormwater as both a construct and piece of infrastructure. And that's kind of something I really focused on a lot in my academic work. So I didn't get to uni till I was like 25 or 6. And so I had some very, you know, well-established likes and dislikes, passions and disinterests. But it's freshwater and the damage that, I guess, Western management and scientific systems do to freshwater systems that really motivates the stuff I do now.
Yeah, so can you tell us a bit about what you're doing now? I heard that you're doing a lot of work around trying to decolonise the current water management approaches that we're using.
Yeah, so I'm currently employed by Monash University to work for Country and Mob in a, what am I, my role is some wanky term, in Research Fellow Indigenous Water. You know, the Academy loves to have these, you know, flash terms.
Yeah.
but really since my PhD, I started my PhD in 2018, I've been working quite hard to decolonise both the Academy and waterways and water management. And the thing about it that I'm really starting to learn, you know, this decolonisation thing's quite a journey, is that the answer will probably look different wherever you are.
Yeah.
So, you know, because each mob's got its own way, so we're going to have different priorities anyway as we seek to nation rebuild.
Yeah.
We've all been impacted by colonisation in, sure, very broadly the same ways, but the impacts to individual clans or family groups or waterways has been quite different. So the way we go about decolonising and nation building, rebuilding in response to that, I think is actually going to be quite specific, as well as having a kind of a universal overarching theme. And one of them is that we just need our water rights back. We just need to, well, not back because we've never lost them, but they need to be respected.
Yeah, definitely.
And put absolutely at the forefront of water management and water science in this country.
Yeah. And it's such an integral part of, you know, not just the ecosystem, but everything, you know, like that whole slogan, water is life. It's so understated in itself, that slogan. You know what I mean?
Totally,
it's so
understated.
Much more than just life. It's everything.
Yep. Well, and that's the thing though, right? For us mob, water has life. It's kin.
Yep.
It's something we love and respect and have a relationship with, right? Water, rivers, streams. You know, in Wiradjuri, Murrumbidja, or in English, Murrumbidji. Murrumbidja, when it's translated into English, means good friend.
Mm.
That's our relationship with that river. Like, it's a living entity that we respect and respond to. And it's that relationship or that relationality that we have as mob with all aspects of country, not just water country, but all aspects of country, that is totally missing in Western ways of doing stuff because it's so transactional.
Yes.
You know, the Western way is like, you do this and I'll do that for you, but we're not mates.
Yeah.
We don't have a relationship because we've just swapped a transaction. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's such a disrespectful way to do business as well. Like, you know, it's such a disrespectful way to, you know, interact with the environment and the ecosystem and these natural resources and each other too.
Oh, totally. And each other. So I actually think respect is a really important thing that's fundamentally lacking in the way, you know, Western science and Western management goes about dealing with all those really critical aspects of country, water, land, animals, soil, sky. You know, we could sit here and list them, and not one of them is respected by the Western systems.
Yeah, and, you know, that's you know, we talk a lot about this on this program as well in the past. You know, any of the regular listeners probably heard us bang on about this so many times already. But, you know, that respect is such an integral part of our culture, but it's also, you know, how we made sure that for 60,000 plus years, we were able to be sustainable, you know, we were able to live in harmony with our environments and with each other. It's that respect underpins so much and it is so lacking. And, you know, something we like to talk about and the way we like to kind of frame stuff for listeners is, you know, we look at our relationship with the land somewhat like our relationship with our mother. And, you know, you're full of respect for your mother and likewise you should be full of the same respect for the land.
Yeah.
Also, it's really interesting what you mentioned about Murrumbidgee meaning friend.
Good mate.
Yeah, good mate, sorry, in the, you know, that lingo up there. You know, in my own language, Dooruga from the Yuin Nation, our word for water is also a synonym for grandmother.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, it really ties into that whole, you know, respecting the land and seeing the land as, seeing us as a part of that land and, you know, descending from it.
And that we all have, like, relationships that we have to value, respect, honour and reciprocate.
Yeah.
You know, I love language and the way you learn it, or learn all sorts of stuff like that is a really interesting link.
Yeah,
that,
definitely.
That word means grandmother and ward. I mean, that's a very telling link, I think.
Yeah.
See, in Wiradjuri, Yinjimara is the word for respect. Go slow, be polite, honourable. But it's really like our ethos. It's the way we're supposed to function throughout the world.
Yes.
It's our primary thing to do is we need to yinjimara as we walk around the world, and it is fundamentally about respect.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's so important, and, you know, it's something that we really, really want listeners to, you know, start to really think about and conceptualise and start to embody as well.
Yeah, and you can do it in really small, simple, quiet, private ways if you're not sure or comfortable about what you're doing. So I'm part of a river listening collective where it's led by Ngunnawal mob. Like, we've got permission and because we do it on Ngunnawal border. And so, but there's quite a few white fellas in there, and I have encouraged all of them to find or develop some sort of ritual or greeting or some way of when they come to this thing every, you know, third Friday of the month or whenever it is they don't just barrel down to the group on the mats and just, you know, start talking shit. Is they actually, they need to come down from the car park and approach river first and speak to Murrumbidgee first and build a relationship with Murrumbidgee before actually approaching the rest of the group as a part of that respect relationship building thing that we've been discussing this morning. And it's interesting how Some non-Indigenous people are quite, I don't know, is put out the right word? You know, they're a bit like, what do you mean I need to build a relationship with the
yeah,
river?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's sort of interesting. Because some people just go, oh, of course, yes, absolutely. And then they go off and then suddenly they're gone for 20 minutes because they're having this bright old yarn with Murrumbidgee. It's forgotten we all exist.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's really interesting too, you know, how some people, you know, non-Indigenous people in particular, how, you know, some of them do embrace that and, you know what we're talking about when we say go, you know, introduce yourself to the river.
Yeah.
But then there's, those other fellas that kind of give you those funny looks and like, what are you talking about, mate?
Yeah.
It's a bit of water. Like, how can I talk to it?
Yeah. You'd be crazy, lady.
Yeah.
It's okay. I'm happy to be the crazy lady if it means that people learn that they can actually talk to water and it will talk back.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Sorry. You go.
I was just going to say, one of the things, like, for people who want to maybe decolonize their relationship with water, a really good way of doing it, not as readily accessible as I would like, but to actually listen to water. Like, you can get equipment that you can stick in the water and listen to what's going on in there.
Mm.
And that's when you start to get a real sense of just how alive water is.
Yeah. And another thing, too, I've been noticing a lot lately, not to sound like a bit of a crazy person myself, but, I've been going down to a lot of the creeks and stuff lately just to, I find it's a good place to go sit down and just spend half an hour just, as you're saying, listening to the water and listening to the birds and, just kind of grounding yourself a bit. But something I've been really noticing lately is that all the creeks, they have this almost like pulse to them. If you, you sit long enough and you watch long enough, you notice they kind of like pulse in and out. And
If we were on Zoom now, you'd see me emphatically nodding my head up and down going, absolutely. And I've got a couple of recordings of, one is of Murrumbidgee, and I can't remember where the other one is, but you can actually hear like a pulse.
Mm.
It's a deep, resonant, I'm not the only one here. We are not crazy, okay? You and I are not crazy. Those who can't hear this are the crazy ones.
Yeah.
No, there's definitely something there. Mm. Country has a real...
It's alive.
Totally. I was going to say like a life or a lifeblood, but it is totally alive. And if you open your ears and open your eyes, you can see and hear that so clearly.
Yeah, definitely. And, I think that's another thing too. When we look at, Western and European outlooks on life, it's, viewing the land as this dead, inanimate object that, is just there for profit. But then when you look at indigenous epistemologies and ontologies, we very much view the land as, something that is very much alive and thriving and, more alive than we are.
Yeah. And kind of in charge of it.
Yeah, exactly. And, that's another, going completely off tangents and topics here, but, that's another thing that we've been talking about a lot lately on this program and some other similar programs about how, that whole Western outlook about, for Indigenous people, right? Sorry, I'm getting all over the place here. For Indigenous people, we're very much, I suppose you could say, subservient to the land. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We see the land as, above us and, we have to be accountable to country.
Yep.
But then you look at these Western ways of viewing land and it's very much the other way around. They believe the land belongs to them as opposed to they belong to the land.
Yeah. And that the land is there for their purposes, and their purposes primarily.
Yeah.
If it so happens that the land can also support a nice stand of trees with some cuddly koalas, that's lovely. But ultimately, if those trees and koalas are in the way of what I want to do with that land, they've got to go.
Yeah.
And it's totally unsentimental. It's totally selfish. I've long thought that Western Europeans, but particularly like the English, have a real fetish for land as opposed to water.
Mm.
And they don't really realise how much the land on which they stand, work and build themselves up on is actually utterly dependent on water.
Yes.
Not even just for something simple like, the watering of your crops or the drinking water for your animals, but the actual even like the shape of the property that you're running, or
and all those other stuff too, like the topsoil erosion and the way that nutrients are distributed, and there's so much more to it.
I've never really understood that land fetish, but I think a lot of it comes back to power and control, and something I work a lot with is this thing called Aquanullius. Have you guys talked about it on the station at all?
I think Uncle Robbie has yarned about it a few times. It's definitely a term I've heard before, but I haven't looked much into, not yet.
It's basically the unofficial policy on which the current water system that we're all subject to operates. So when Whitey rocked up in 1788 and the first bit of water that they took, because, you can imagine how long they were off the boat before they were stealing water.
Mm.
The first time they took water was an act of Aquanullius because they were disregarding Indigenous water rights, right?
Yeah.
And so that set the tone for the way water is done by the settler state, basically, ever since. And I think that, I mean, I think it's fairly obvious when you get to Australia that it's much drier than many other parts of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think when they got here, I don't know, I'm just, this is just, you know, me having a little thought experiment. They quite quickly worked out that actually water was more valuable than land. So where they came from, the land was more valuable. You got more power and prestige and profit from owning land. But that, in Australia, like what we now call Australia, I think it would have been quite obvious up front that you could have all the actual physical land in the world, but if it's not raining for 9 or 10 months, you're actually screwed.
Yeah.
And that's why they got so vicious, particularly vicious about water. Because, you know, most of the massacres, like, no one's done the figures, but I've looked at the map a lot. I use it quite a bit in some of the teaching that I do. I'd say close to 75% of the massacres that have occurred, that are recorded as having occurred on the massacre map, would be about water, control of waterways, access to waterways. And you can see it. You can see it in the naming when you drive over creeks. You know, like Poison Creek Waterholes. Poison Waterhole Creek is something I have to drive over when I go to Mildura. So you know what happened there, right? I mean, that's awful.
Yeah. But I think you're onto something too about, you know, like quite a lot of these massacre sites were over water. Control of water resources. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Absolutely, because, I mean, you can thrive on a small parcel of land on this continent if you have adequate water.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, because that's the thing, like our water knowledge, our water science is fucking amazing. Like, you know, people, where people could live with the quality of water that they had just cannot and has not been matched by the contemporary Western water system.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And
Go ahead.
There's all these problems as well that we're seeing, you know, crop up with the contemporary water management stuff, and not just, you know, the basic problems that anyone would expect, like stuff like, you know, droughts and accessibility to water, and not even like the pollution that we might all be familiar with, but we've got all these new pollutants and stuff popping up now, like, you know, we've got PFAS in rainwater and stuff now.
Yeah.
You know, it's in all the rivers and creeks, and, you know, it's something that people aren't really talking about or...
And nanoplastics and all those sorts of things.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, no, there's... Well, I've read somewhere, like The Guardian, somewhere relatively reliable, that fetuses now have nanoplastics in them.
Yeah, yeah, well, you're right. It's in pretty much everybody now. And, you know, this is another horrific little notifier, but they can't actually do proper studies on the impacts of nanoplastics and microplastics within our body because there's no sample group in the world that doesn't have them in them.
That's very scary.
Yep. Yeah, look, yeah, they can't pull a sample group that doesn't have microplastics and nanoplastics in them.
That's terrible. That's a very large experiment that none of us have given free prior informed consent to, isn't it?
Yep.
And those things that are travelling our bodies also travel on the waterways, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
They're quite soluble, a lot of those things, and do get around relatively easily in waterways, even if they're sometimes caught up in soils and things. You know, they're ultimately released again. So many years ago, I was working in water quality, and I stepped away because we, as a broader society, you know, as a modern nation state, we actually know what causes water pollution, and we kind of know many ways to solve the problem. And yet we don't do any of those things, and I find that really frustrating. And I've inadvertently I've indirectly come back to water pollution through the work I'm doing now. And it's so frustrating that the Western system will not correct course when it knows it's wrong, because the profit motive is so much stronger.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about the bottom line of the dollar at the end of the day for them.
It totally is. And this is water that we're talking about. Like, we have today discussed two really important things about water. One, it is alive, and two, it keeps us alive.
Yeah.
I mean, they're two pretty important things. And to keep treating water like it is actually a resource that you can keep filtering and chlorinating and heating, like all the stuff that's done to water, even just through treatment processes, let alone all the production, like water's quite used, it's heavily used in all sorts of production activities and it's quite badly treated. But even if you just look at water treatment for domestic water, sewage purposes, water cops are bashing, you know, they put microbes in it, they burst it with ultraviolet light. It's a living thing.
Yeah.
And we don't, I guess it's a bit like the big experiment with microplastics. As a community, as a nation state, we don't actually know what all that does to water in the long run, those sorts of behaviours,
yeah,
or treatments rather.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of these problems have only popped up in the last, you know, decade or two, 3 decades.
Yep.
And we've got no idea what it's going to look like in 100 years.
No.
I mean, we don't even know if we're going to be here in 100 years the way things are going, but you know, that's another story.
Personally, I'm not optimistic. I think we'll end up like a rump species. There'll be like a handful of us, you know, going, what the hell happened there? How come no one told us this was going to happen? That actually, I don't know how much longer we've got for me to have a rant, but it's one of the things about this interest on the part of non-Indigenous institutions or settler state institutions in Indigenous knowledges is that it's come about now because their system is so useless. So they're going to come and mine our system and exploit our knowledges. And they're not going to want to, unless we can, you know, convince them, and I have many ferocious conversations with people trying to convince them that when non-Indigenous peoples ask to use the data that we've generated over millennia or even in the last 235 years, that they need to take that data with the frameworks and the beliefs, like the ontology that sits over all of that, like they take the data and then just plug it straight into that transactional Western science system.
Yes, yeah, no, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no, it doesn't, because they're completely, like, as we've discussed, they're completely opposite to each other in their values and beliefs, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of my big worries about the academy. You know, they talk about decolonising and... But they're very good at...
Just co-opting our knowledge
for their own stuff. That's the word, co-opting, absolutely.
Yeah.
They'll take a term and then they'll just do what they want to do with it anyway, right?
Yep.
So we all need to be on alert for when someone says, can you share some knowledge? Ask them if they're willing to learn your beliefs that match that knowledge, like, you know, that water is alive, that country is the boss.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, we are just about to wrap up with this show, but yeah, thanks heaps for coming on, and I think if you're up for it, I might get you on again in, you know, a couple of weeks or something to have a bit more of a yarn.
Yeah, no, as you can tell, I don't mind a natter, Kieran. And really, I do see my role very much as one that's for country and mob, so it's important that mob know what I'm doing, and so if they need a hand, they can get in touch with me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, sounds good. Just quickly on that note, do you have anywhere that you would recommend listeners go if they want to learn more, like a social media or a website or anything like that?
More about what in particular, Kieran?
Just the work that you're doing around decolonising waterways and, you know, management.
So I'm also part of a yarning circle that a Ewan guy and a non-Indigenous friend of ours have set up at Trennis School at ANU, which is a decolonising research and teaching circle. And we actually, if you're interested in decolonising the academy, we have a website that people might like.
Yeah.
It's decolyarns, I need to write it down, that's terrible. decolyarns, yeah. DECOLOYARNS .org, decolyarms.org.
Yeah, right.
It's going to be officially launched next week, so you're all ahead of the game there.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, if you're interested in Decolonising the Academy, please do have a look at that. It will give you some really good information and a bunch of useful references.
Yeah, right. Yeah, cheers for that. And, yeah, just for the listeners, I'll plug that on the 3CR website a bit later after the program.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Alrighty. Yeah, thanks again for jumping on, Kate. And yeah, we'll catch up again in the next couple of weeks.
Excellent.
All right, enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks for talking to me. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Go ahead, you. Bye.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.